You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. We'll lead off this installment with The Cheat Sheet by William D. Cohan, Pride in the Name of Love, How Bono's Investment Partner Got Busted in the College Admissions Scandal, with photo illustrations by Justin Patrick Long. Opening illustration, Bill McGlashan left Bono's Rise Fund after he was charged with paying fixer William Singer to get his son into USC. And in the illustration, Bono is shown flashing the peace sign, $100 bills all around him. Then Bill McGlashan appears looming larger in the middle, wearing a suit, and smaller over to the right of the illustration is William Singer. Interspersed amongst them are the buildings of the University of Southern California. Last January, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Bono sat on a frigid outdoor television set for a friendly chat with Andrew Ross Sorkin, the New York Times columnist and co-creator of the hit show Billions. As it happens, the show, a fictionalized account of a hedge fund billionaire and the federal prosecutor who sets out to bring him down, provided a bit of ironic foreshadowing at the annual gathering of the world's wealthiest do-gooders. Joining Bono on stage that morning was William McGlashan Jr., a managing partner at TPG Growth, who had helped the U2 frontman launch the Rise Fund, a $2 billion portfolio of investments committed to creating social and environmental impact that leads to meaningful, measurable, and positive change. In a Times column, Sorkin once described McGlashan as resembling a Buddhist monk more than a cigar-chomping banker in pinstripes. Now, improbably bundled against the cold in both a vest and a parka, McGlashan was swathed in a sea of gray down. Bono, sporting his signature black leather jacket and purple spectacles, recounted how he and McGlashan came up with their vision for Rise, which has invested in everything from supporting small dairy farms in India to expanding financial access to the poor in Nigeria. We had this wild and crazy idea that capitalism, this tool that had taken more people out of extreme poverty than any other ism, could perhaps be deployed to support the work I was doing trying to get people out of extreme poverty, Bono explained. But he, gesturing to McGlashan, also accepted that it's a wild beast, and if not tamed, can and has chewed up a lot of lives. Sorkin asked the pair how often they discussed the investments that Rise has made since its founding in 2016. All the time, McGlashan gushed. Later, at the conference, on another panel with Bono, he summed up Rise's Save the World ethos. Businesses go extinct if they don't get on the side of authentic good, McGlashan declared. We need to hold ourselves humbly accountable and deliver on the promise of impact investing. That business can solve these otherwise intractable problems that we are facing. What McGlashan did not share with his fellow elites at Davos, humbly or otherwise, was something he had known for months, that federal authorities were closing in on a college admissions fixer he had allegedly conspired with to get his older son into the University of Southern California. As part of the scandal known as Operation Varsity Blues, prosecutors say McGlashan paid the fixer $50,000 to falsify his son's ACT scores. As additional insurance, he allegedly discussed paying a bribe of $250,000 to gain his son admission through a side door at USC as a promising athlete, enabling him to do an end run around the entire application process. On March 12th, 6 weeks after Davos, McGlashan was arrested at his home in Marin County, California, and charged with conspiracy to commit mail fraud. After TPG placed him on leave, he either resigned or was fired, depending on which version of events you choose to believe. But unlike some of the other high-profile defendants in the scandal, including the actor Felicity Huffman, McGlashan decided to fight the criminal charges. He essentially claims he did nothing wrong. While he admits to making a $50,000 payment to the fixer, he says there is no allegation that the extra time his son was provided to take the ACT was obtained fraudulently or was unwarranted. What's more, he asserts, he never paid $250,000 to get his son into USC through the side door. And his son, sad to say, has now withdrawn his college applications. The prosecutor's case against Mr. McGlashan is deeply flawed and ignores important exculpatory facts, his attorney said. We look forward to presenting his side of the story. McGlashan's colleagues at TPG were stunned. Given his prominence as one of the world's leading advocates of social impact investing, the ethos of doing well by doing good, his fall from grace has the potential to undercut projects that help millions worldwide. What he did was inexcusable and just reprehensible, says John Winkelried, the co-CEO of TPG. It makes it all the more distasteful because of the things he proclaimed he stood for. It makes people second-guess what our motivations were. Because the personal and the professional, given how vocal he was, kind of bleed together. Anan Girharadas, a visiting scholar at New York University and author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, seconds that concern. We have to understand McGlashan being arrested as a moment of reckoning for the headmaster of a big experiment in social change, he says. When someone like that is caught showing how desperately they cling to the status quo, and how clinging to the status quo is so overpowering that they're willing to break federal law, it doesn't just implicate one man. It raises a question about the sincerity of a lot of people in that field, because the whole premise of impact investing is that the rich, while advancing social justice, should actually make a buck from it. A legacy graduate of both Yale and the Stanford Graduate School of Business, McGlashan joined TPG in 2004 after a stint at Bain Capital. Some who worked with him were struck by his hunger for fame. There's no one more obsessed with red carpets and celebrities than this guy, says a former colleague. I mean, it's sad to watch for a grown-up. Everything was really about him becoming a star at TPG. The first conversation we ever had was him telling me he wanted everybody to know his name. Impact investing provided McGlashan with his own star turn. In 2016, he co-founded Rise with Bono and Jeff Skoll, the billionaire first employee and president of eBay, and attracted a host of Silicon Valley luminaries to its founders' board, including Reid Hoffman, Pierre Omidyar, and Lorraine Powell Jobs. Before long, Rise was pouring millions into micro-lending in China, coding classes in Argentina, and wilderness protection in Botswana. In 2017, the fund's success earned McGlashan a spot at number 66 on Vanity Fair's new establishment list, higher than Beyoncé and Reese Witherspoon, but lower than J.J. Abrams and Dwayne Johnson. That same year, as McGlashan was traveling the world to preach the gospel of socially responsible investing, federal prosecutors say he entered into a cheating scheme to benefit his son, then a student at a high school in Marin County. According to a federal affidavit, McGlashan conspired to bribe Donna Hynell, the senior associate athletics director at USC, to facilitate his son's admission to USC as a recruited athlete. McGlashan agreed to make a purported donation of $50,000 to the Key Worldwide Foundation, which was run by William Singer, the fixer who has confessed to the bribery scheme. In return, Singer would arrange for McGlashan's son to take his college admission test at a center in West Hollywood controlled by Singer, and then have an associate correct his son's answers after the test was completed. On December 6, 2017, according to the affidavit, McGlashan donated $50,000 to Key Worldwide from his personal charitable gift fund. 2 days later, according to cell tower records, the cell phones belonging to both McGlashan and his son traveled from the San Francisco area to Los Angeles, where the aspiring college student was given 2 days to take his ACT exam. Afterward, according to the affidavit, an associate of Singer's corrected his answers. The associate has since pleaded guilty. The younger McGlashan, whom the family claims was diagnosed by a pediatric neuropsychologist with certain learning disabilities, received a score of 34 out of a possible 36. Next illustration. What McGlashan did was reprehensible, says TPG's co-CEO, because of the things he proclaimed he stood for, and he's shown here sitting on a sofa. McGlashan was not done. In July 2018, in a phone call recorded by the FBI, Singer explained to McGlashan how he could get his kid into USC. For an additional payment of $250,000, he said the boy would be accepted before he even applies. That would be great, McGlashan said. I'd do that in a heartbeat. Singer explained that the draft acceptance letter from USC would come to McGlashan in the fall, with the official letter arriving in March. After the first letter, Singer told McGlashan, a $50,000 check for women's athletics was due, with the balance of $200,000 payable after the official letter came in March. I love it, McGlashan said. Singer explained how the scam would work. He would create a profile of McGlashan's son as an athlete that USC would be interested in recruiting. McGlashan tried to be helpful. Well, we have images of him in lacrosse, he told Singer. I don't know if that matters. USC doesn't have a lacrosse team, Singer lamented, but football is big business at the school. All he needed was a picture of McGlashan's son playing football. Unfortunately, his son's high school didn't have a football team. No problem, Singer told McGlashan a few weeks later in another intercepted phone call. I'm going to make him a kicker, Singer said. He would simply use Photoshop to place the son's face on the body of a high school football player. He had used the trick before, turning one 145-pound kid into a long snapper on the football team. The guy who runs the biggest kicking camp is a good friend, Singer explained, so we'll put a bunch of stuff about that on his profile, and we should be in pretty good shape to get that done. Kickers, he added, get preferential treatment in admissions. Yeah, perfect, McGlashan said. Perfect. So I'm going to make him a kicker, Singer said. McGlashan laughed. He does have really strong legs, he said. Maybe he'll become a kicker. You never know. Yeah, Singer replied, absolutely. You could inspire him, McGlashan said. You may actually turn him into something. I love it. He promised to get Singer some photos of his son. Let me look through what I have, he said. Pretty funny. The way the world works these days is unbelievable. At one point, McGlashan offered to call USC board members to lobby for his son. Half the board knows me, he said. But Singer urged him to hold off while he worked his connections at the USC athletics department. McGlashan agreed to sit tight. McGlashan did express a qualm about the scheme. He didn't want his kid to find out that his dad had rigged his entry into USC. His son, apparently, held himself to a higher ethical standard. In the July phone call, Singer assured him that his son wouldn't know about the side door, only that Singer would take his stuff and get him some help. McGlashan, who made his fortune pitching morality to billionaires, was apparently fine with deceiving his own child. His son, he told Singer, would have no issue with that arrangement. You lobbying for him, you helping use your network, no issue. Things started to unravel for McGlashan last fall when Singer was approached by the FBI and began cooperating with law enforcement. In late October, after agreeing to plead guilty to obstruction of justice, Singer called McGlashan at the urging of the FBI and told him that the IRS was looking into the payments from Key Worldwide to the associate who took the test for his son in West Hollywood. Singer told McGlashan that he was worried he was being followed and wiretapped. That was why he was calling McGlashan from his son's cell phone, so that there are, you know, no issues, just in case. McGlashan, so talkative on the earlier wiretaps, suddenly grew cryptic and monosyllabic. Yep, he told Singer. Yep. At his initial court appearance in San Francisco in March, McGlashan was ordered to post $1 million in bail and surrender his passport. But the private equity mogul had a different idea. His lawyers argued that he should be allowed to travel to Mexico for a long-planned family trip during his children's spring break from their private school. Given his deep ties to his home state, McGlashan hails from seven generations of Californians. They insisted he posed a minimal flight risk. Prosecutors, arguing that McGlashan had essentially acknowledged the cheating in the wiretapped phone calls, suggested that he and his family could spend spring break in Montana at their $12 million home there. The judge ruled that McGlashan had to remain in the United States. Inside TPG, McGlashan's arrest set off a frantic scramble to contain the damage. That morning, Winkelride, the firm's co-CEO, was also in Marin County, attending a meeting at the Cavallo Point Lodge. He quickly huddled with David Bonderman and James Coulter, the firm's two founding partners, and Brad Berenson, the firm's general counsel. After reading the federal affidavit, the executives immediately placed McGlashan on administrative leave without pay. The following day, TPG says, he was fired. McGlashan insists that he resigned. Coulter, co-CEO with Winkelried, has stepped in to manage Rise, which is in the process of raising $3.5 billion for a second fund. Moving his office to the fund's base of operations, two floors below the firm's C-suites, he has been in regular touch with Rise's high-powered founders board. Coulter has also been trying to steady the fund's 100 or so employees. People were shocked, Winkelride says. Several employees at the Rise Fund have children who are seniors in high school, making what McGlashan allegedly did all the more disturbing. I was shocked that he would have been so careless says a senior member of the Rise Fund team. Mostly because, ultimately, it hurts your kids when you do this. What he has done to his family and his children, who will live with this the rest of their lives. After McGlashan's arrest, TPG hired Ropes and Gray, a Boston-based law firm, to conduct an internal investigation into whether any other person or part of TPG was aware or implicated in Bill's alleged misconduct. The investigation found no fraud in McGlashan's handling of the firm's finances. At one point, however, he introduced Singer to members of TPG's team as a potential investment opportunity. The firm, after reviewing the proposition, decided against it. Based on the findings, TPG announced that it was recapturing McGlashan's interest in both Rise funds, a decision that is almost certain to provoke a legal dispute. At the time of his arrest, McGlashan had already closed on $800 million in investments for the new Rise Fund. TPG has offered to allow investors to withdraw their commitments, and some major players are weighing their options. A spokesman for the State Investment Council of New Jersey, which has committed $200 million to the two Rise funds, said the state is reviewing the impact of McGlashan's departure and will take whatever steps are appropriate. Bono declined to comment on McGlashan's arrest, but a source close to him says that the singer was shocked and then furious when he heard what his partner had allegedly done. But he's sticking with Rise. He's not letting this deter him, the source says. He just feels there are big challenges we're facing that won't be solved by government alone. Government is essential, but we need to leverage private capital, too. One person who is standing by McGlashan is his brother-in-law, Bill Price, a TPG partner emeritus who brought him into the firm. I'm as shocked as anyone else at the allegation, Price says by phone from Mallorca, where he and his family are spending the year. But I am aware that at this point it's just allegations. He points out that the federal affidavit contains only excerpts of McGlashan's wiretapped phone calls. I hope that when Bill gets to tell his side of the story, it will look different than it looks today, he says. But no question, it's shocking to think of Bill being involved in some of the things that have been alleged. It just seems totally out of character for him. Price acknowledges the irony of the charges leveled against McGlashan, given his history as a leading champion of socially responsible investment. Anytime someone is putting themselves out there as someone who believes in doing good in the world and wanting to make a difference, and has spent a lot of his life talking about the issues we face as a society and trying to do something about it, when allegations are made that they don't live that way in their private life, yeah, you're going to get a lot of heat, Price concedes. You put yourself out there, and you establish a position for who you are in life. There are always plenty of people who are willing to look for flaws, real or not. Garrett Aradas, the NYU scholar, says the disconnect goes beyond a single individual like McGlashan. It's baked into the zero-sum nature of capitalism itself. After all, if you try to generate a favorable return for yourself on a social impact portfolio, you're ultimately profiting from someone else's misfortune. Just as the wealthy parents caught up in the admissions scandal took spots that might otherwise have gone to highly qualified students without the resources or inclination to game the system. Giraderadas points to a quotation from Tolstoy that he used as an epigraph in Winners Take All. I sit on a man's back, choking him and making him carry me, Tolstoy wrote, and yet assure myself and others that I am sorry for him and wish to lighten his load by all means possible, except by getting off his back. Giridharadas reflects on the image for a moment, then he shrugs. I can't describe this situation better than Tolstoy in that quote, he says. Bill McGlashan is Tolstoy in the quote. Here's some news from the Vanity Fair agenda. Event: Vanity Fair celebrates Dior from Paris to the world. This past March, Dior and Vanity Fair celebrated the upcoming exhibit Dior, From Paris to the World, at the Dallas Museum of Art, with a high-caliber shopping event at the brand's Highland Park Village boutique. Celebrity stylist Aaron Walsh was on hand to present the Dior's Spring-Summer 2019 collection, alongside event co-host Nancy Rogers, Jean Jones, Charlotte Jones Anderson, and Jordan Jones. Shop. Dosist celebrates flagship launch. Cannabis-based wellness company Dosist launched their first flagship in the heart of Venice, California, at 1423 Abbott Kinney Boulevard. The event was celebrated with an exclusive launch party. Watch. Yellowstone Season 2 premieres June 19th on Paramount Network. From Taylor Sheridan, Sicario, Hell or High Water, and starring Kevin Costner, Yellowstone, cable's number one new drama, returns for its second season. Costner is John Dutton, family patriarch and fierce defender of the sprawling Montana ranch his family has owned for over a century. As modern-day forces threaten his property, Dutton will use any means necessary to protect his family's legacy. Here's this month's cover story, Tour de Force. After 4 decades, Star Wars is drawing to its epic conclusion. Lev Grossman goes behind the scenes with director J.J. Abrams and the cast for the first look at the rise of Skywalker. Exclusive photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, shooting stars. Director J.J. Abrams sets up a shot of Daisy Ridley, Rey, and Jordan's Wadi Rum desert, the setting for the planet Rassana, or Passana, rather, in the desert, says Abrams. There's something about the way the sand interacts with the light. There's a desert valley in southern Jordan called Wadi Rum, or sometimes the Valley of the Moon. There are stone inscriptions in Wadi Rum that are more than 2,000 years old. Lawrence of Arabia passed through there during the Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire. More recently, J.J. Abrams went there to film parts of the latest Star Wars movie, The Rise of Skywalker, because it's largely uninhabited and starkly beautiful and looks plausibly alien. And one of the things that has always made the Star Wars movies feel so real, as if they had a real life of their own that continues on out beyond the edges of the screen, is the way they are shot on location with as few digital effects as possible. George Lucas shot the Tatooine scenes from A New Hope in southern Tunisia. For Skywalker, it's Wadi Rum. They don't do it this way because it's easy. Abrams and his crew had to build miles of road into the desert. They basically had to set up a small town out there, populated by the cast and extras and crew. The creature effects department alone had 70 people. The Jordanian military got involved. The Jordanian royal family got involved. There was sand. There were sandstorms, when all you could do was take cover and huddle in your tent. And if you're John Boyega, who plays the ex-stormtrooper Finn, listen to reggae. But in a way, that's the whole point. You're out there so the world can get up in your grill and make its presence felt on film. It's the things that you can't anticipate, the imperfections, says Oscar Isaac, who plays the resistance pilot Poe Dameron. It's very difficult to design imperfection, and the imperfections that you have in these environments immediately create a sense of authenticity. You just believe it more. When Isaac arrived in Wadi Rum for his first week of shooting, Abrams had set up a massive green screen in the middle of the desert. And I was like, J.J., can I ask you a question? I notice we're shooting on green screen. And he's like, so why the hell are we in the desert? And I'm like, yeah. And he said, well, because look, the way that the sand interacts with the light and the type of shots you would set up, if you were designing the shot on a computer, you would never even think to do that. There's something about the way that the light and the environment and everything plays together. It's that something, the presence and the details, and the analog imperfections of a real non-digital place that makes Star Wars so powerful. It was powerful enough to bring 65,000 people to Chicago in April for Star Wars Celebration, a fan convention where you could see a giant stormtrooper head made out of 36,440 tiny Lego stormtrooper minifigures, which is a world record of some kind, though I'm not sure exactly what, and where people were dressed up as Muppets, who were themselves dressed up as Star Wars characters. But the main event was the launch of the trailer for The Rise of Skywalker, which was held in a 10,000-seat arena and was such a big deal that even though the trailer was going to be released on the Internet literally seconds after it was over, I, an at least theoretically respectable member of the media, was not only tagged, wristbanded, escorted, and metal detected, but sniffed by a canine unit before I could go in. I sat down with Abrams a couple of hours later. For the occasion, he was wearing a suit so black and sharp he could have been doing Men in Black cosplay, but his most distinctive figure is his dark curly hair. His most distinctive feature is his dark curly hair, which is upswept in a way that is only slightly suggestive of devil horns. Abrams talks rapidly, as if he can barely keep up with the things his racing brain is telling him to say. When I told him that not only was Star Wars the number one trending topic on Twitter, but that all 10 of the top 10 trending topics were Star Wars related, and that he personally was number 5, he was visibly stunned. Then he recovered enough to say, "Well, I aspire to number 4. For the record, number 4 was the late Supreme Leader Snoke, who frankly did seem beatable. If you're curious, number 11 was pro golfer Zach Johnson, who had just accidentally hit his ball with a practice swing at the Masters. Life goes on. Disney executives talk about how important it is to eventize Star Wars movies. In other words, to make them feel not just like movies, but like seriously momentous occasions. They won't have much trouble with this one. The Rise of Skywalker isn't just the last movie in the Star Wars trilogy that began in 2015 with The Force Awakens. It's the last movie in a literal, actual trilogy of trilogies that started with the very first Star Wars movie back in 1977, which began the saga of the Skywalker family. The Rise of Skywalker will finally, after 42 years, bring that saga to an end. We all thought the story was over in 1983 with Return of the Jedi, and then we really thought it was over in 2005 with Revenge of the Sith. But Star Wars has always been an unruly beast, too big and powerful and profitable to be contained in one movie, or even in a trilogy, or even in two trilogies, let alone numberless novels, TV shows, comics, video games, Happy Meals, and so on. Now Abrams has to gather all those threads and bring closure to a story that was started by somebody else, in an America that feels a very long time ago indeed. That's the challenge of this movie, Abrams says. It wasn't just to make one film that, as a standalone experience, would be thrilling and scary and emotional and funny, but one that if you were to watch all 9 of the films, you'd feel like, well, of course, that. Like a lot of things that we now can't imagine life without, Star Wars came really close to never happening in the first place. In 1971, Lucas was a serious young auteur just 5 years out of film school at USC. He had only one full-length movie on his resume, and that was THX 1138, which is the kind of visionary but grindingly earnest science fiction epic that only the French could love. They were pretty much the only ones who did. Everybody expected Lucas to go on and make serious, gritty 1970s cinema like his peers, Brian De Palma and Francis Ford Coppola. At the time, Lucas and Coppola were actively planning a radical epic set in Vietnam with a provocative title, Apocalypse Now. But Coppola would have to finish that one on his own because Lucas went a different way. "I had decided there was no modern mythology," he said in 1997. "I wanted to take old myths and put them into a new format that young people could relate to." Mythology always existed in unusual, unknown environments, so I chose space. Lucas tried to acquire the rights to Flash Gordon. That would have been a dark timeline indeed. But when he couldn't, he came up with his own original science fictional epic instead. He called it the Star Wars. Like the Facebook, it would have to shed a direct article on its way to glory. Even though American Graffiti had made Lucas a bankable director, Star Wars still came together slowly. In the first draft, Luke was an old man. Leia was 14, and Han Solo was a huge, green-skinned monster with no nose and large gills. Fox executives were baffled by Star Wars, and they squeezed Lucas relentlessly for time and money. We forget now how jerry-rigged the first movie was. The Cantina aliens weren't finished, and the monumental Star Destroyer that dominates the opening shot is, in reality, about 3 feet long. The Death Star interior is basically one set, rearranged several different ways. To make Greedo's mouth move, the woman in the Greedo suit had to hold a clothespin in her mouth. "What I remember about working on the first film," says John Williams, the legendary soundtrack composer, "is the fact that I didn't ever think there would be a second film." He also, like everybody else, thought Luke and Leia were going to get together, so he wrote them a love theme. But wherever real mythology comes from, Lucas had gone there and brought something back alive. People wanted movies that gave them something to believe in, instead of relentlessly autopsying the beliefs that had failed them. We'd had enough of anti-heroes. We needed some anti-anti-heroes. I realized after THX that people don't care about how the country's being ruined, Lucas said. We've got to regenerate optimism, like American graffiti. Star Wars is a work of profound nostalgia, a post-Vietnam, post-Watergate anthem of longing for the restoration of a true and just power in the universe, the return of the king. And at the same time, it's a very personal hero's journey, about a boy who must put the sins of his father and master the strange power he finds within himself. He must put right the sins of his father, and in doing so become a man. Star Wars is also an incredibly enduring vision of what it's like to live in a world of super-advanced technology. Science fiction often ages badly, turning into kitsch or camp. Just look at Flash Gordon. But Star Wars hasn't. More than any filmmaker before him, Lucas successfully imagined what a science fictional world would feel like to somebody who was actually inside it, which is to say it would look as ordinary and workaday as the present. He even shot it like it was real, working close in and mostly eschewing wide establishing shots, more like a documentary or a newsreel than a space opera. "It feels very grounded," says Naomi Ackie, who's making her Star Wars debut in Skywalker, playing a character named Janna, about whom she is allowed to say literally nothing. There's the kind of spectacularness and the supernatural move-things-with-your-mind magic stuff, but then there's also this really grounded, rugged nature where everything is distressed and old and kind of worn out and lived in. And I think playing with those two ideas means that you get this feeling that it could almost be real, like in a galaxy far away. It could almost be the case that you could have this. When Lucas made the first Star Wars sequel, The Empire Strikes Back, he cheekily labeled it Episode 5, then went back and relabeled the first movie as Episode 4, as if the movies were an old-fashioned serial that the rest of us were all just tuning into. Around that time, he also started talking about Star Wars as a 9-part epic. So in 2012, when Lucas retired and sold Lucasfilm to Disney, it wasn't exactly heresy that Disney announced more movies. At the time, Kathleen Kennedy had just been named co-chairperson of Lucasfilm, and she tapped Abrams to direct the first Disney-owned post-Lucas Star Wars movie. It was a bit like saying, "Make the lightning strike again, please. Exactly here, if you could. Oh, and could you also earn back that $4 billion we just spent to buy Lucasfilm?" Narrator voice, he could. At first blush, Abrams' debut Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens, looked like an elaborate homage to the original. Just like in A New Hope, there's a young, force-sensitive person on a poor desert planet. That's Rey, played by Daisy Ridley, who finds a droid with a secret message that's vital to the rebellion. Or wait, sorry, it's the Resistance now. There's a villain in a black mask, just like Darth Vader, except that it's his grandson, Kylo Ren, Adam Driver, née Ben Solo, son of Han and Leia. Kylo has a planet-killing weapon, much like the Death Star, but way bigger, which becomes the target of a desperate attack by Resistance X-Wings. There's even a bar full of aliens. Next photo, Desert Power. Yunus Watamo, Chewbacca, Ridley, Anthony Daniels, C-3PO, and John Boyega, Finn, await the call to action for a chase scene. Abrams also insisted on keeping the analog aesthetic of the original trilogy. Those aliens had to be latex and yak hair, not bits and bytes. And everything possible was shot on location using film cameras, not digital ones. Even Lucas had abandoned that approach by the time he made the second Star Wars trilogy, but many fans consider those movies to be a cautionary tale. Famously, the prequels were mostly green screen environments, Abrams says, and that was George himself doing that, and it ended up looking exactly how he wanted it to look. And I always preferred the look of the original movies, because I just remember when you're in the snow on Hoth, when you're in the desert on Tatooine, and when you're in the forest of Endor, it's amazing. If you put a vaporator here, there, all of a sudden, almost any natural location suddenly becomes a Star Wars location. But the more interesting thing about The Force Awakens and its successor, The Last Jedi, written and directed by Rian Johnson, was how they subtly complicated Lucas's vision. 30 years have gone by since the ending of Return of the Jedi, during which time the newly reborn Republic became complacent and politically stagnant, allowing the rise of the reactionary Neo-Imperial First Order, whose origins we will learn more about in Skywalker. It was almost like if the Argentine Nazis had sort of got together and actually started to bring that back in some real form, Abrams says. Just like that, the rules of the Star Wars universe changed. It wasn't all over when the Ewoks sang, Obi-Wan Kenobi and all those Bothans had died in vain. Even Han and Leia split up. It's all a little less of a fairy tale now. The feather-haired godling Luke suffered the trauma of having a Padawan go bad on his watch. It's an echo of what happened to his old mentor Obi-Wan with Anakin Skywalker, who became Darth Vader. But where Obi-Wan made peace with it, waiting serenely in the desert of Tatooine for the next chosen one to arrive, Luke's guilt curdled into shame. He hid himself away, so that his chosen one, Rey, had to spend most of The Force Awakens searching for him, and then another whole movie convincing him with the help of Yoda's Force Ghost to keep the Jedi Order going at all. Star Wars arrived as an antidote to the disillusionment of the 1970s, but now, in its middle age, Star Wars is grappling with disillusionment of its own. By dint of advanced Sith interrogation techniques, I was able to obtain valuable advance information about the rise of Skywalker. Here it is, common emblem. Anthony Daniels, who plays C-3PO, is the only actor who has appeared in all 9 movies of the Star Wars triple trilogy, so if anybody's entitled to leak, it's him. Daniels says he loved the script for The Rise of Skywalker, but he didn't get it until the last minute, right before shooting started, and for some reason he just couldn't memorize his part. My first line would not go in my head, he says. In person, Daniels is like a C-3PO whose preferences have been reset to charming and voluble. The line that I couldn't say was two words, common emblem, common emblem, common emblem. I would say them thousands of times. My wife would say it back. I just couldn't say them. Fortunately, C-3PO's mouth doesn't move, so he could add the line in post-production. Anyway, there's the big scoop. Common emblem. I don't know what it means either. Also, I 100% guarantee that they will change the line before the movie comes out, so that this scoop will end up being fake news. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.